Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap, Jimmy James and the Blue Flames, Too Busy for Woodstock, Yawk Rock, Here We Come.
Nature's waiting.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
This morning, we tell one of those stories. Hello, this is Doug Cooper, and this is Vinyl Tap. We're coming to you live from the Vinegaroon Saloon and Storage Facility on Frog Song Farm. Out in Wildwood, Texas, yep. Just a little bit south of Austin. I am joined tonight by our very tender and dear, humble producer, Jonathan J. M. Rowe.
Good morning, Tapsters.
We are also joined by Power Pop Tony.
Hey, everybody.
Who's trying to sound very FM today. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to do something unusual. We have a new feature today.
No,
God. I don't have fanfare for this feature, but we have a new feature. These are the Vinyl Tap Episode Awards. Number one award goes to Doug Cooper. This is called Why Is Your Head So Far Up Your Butt Award for not discovering this album a long, long time ago. We have an award for Tony.
Oh.
Tony gets Picking the Album Doug Cooper Should Have Picked Award. And finally, we have another award for Jonathan J.M. Rowe, the What Kind of Sorry Friend Are You Not to Tell Me About This Record a Long Time Ago. As you may have been able to pick up, ladies and gentlemen, from the award portion of our show, this is a pick from Power Pop Tony.
Which is very unusual. This would
well,
be unusual.
It's becoming less and less unusual. I think this is the third or fourth podcast that we've talked about Doug and I switching genres.
You really did, yeah.
I think that this is the most album I would have picked that I didn't pick that's been covered.
Even more than the CCR album?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
CCR is a little more universal than this is.
Yeah.
So almost any rock and roll lover would have picked that record. But this is a little more peculiar to things that float my boat.
Huh. And what album are we talking about?
We should bring that up. I'm going to try to say the name of the album correctly. The 12 Dreams of Dr. Sargonagus.
Sardonicus.
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 Yes,
there which you is, go. I don't know what that is. It's a species of Triassic.
There is a movie called Mr. Sardonicus.
Mr. Sardonicus maybe loosely based on, where this guy gets stuck with this evil-looking grin on his face after he digs up his dad's corpse to find a lottery ticket or something.
Something is bizarre. Okay. It's a
but
horror
it's also
movie.
Yeah. It's a horror
not.
Film.
I gather this is not our recommendations part of the program.
No. It's also supposedly was what the band called the recording console in the studio.
Oh, really?
Sardonicus.
Sardonicus. Yeah.
So I don't know. Who knows? It's.
I wonder where the 12 dreams come from.
Well, it's a loosely,
maybe the movie.
It's a loosely based concept album, but really the only concept is there's supposed to be 12 dreams, and there's 12 and
there's
tracks.
12 songs.
So there you go.
until later Value Packs added three more good songs.
Yeah. They are good songs too.
We don't stray into that complicated territory where they add on the somebody figured out a CD can have more songs and they decide to use up
this
every
album's
space.
Just under 40 minutes, I think.
Mm-hmm. This, ladies and gentlemen, you may be listening to us thinking, "Dude, I never even heard these guys before, so I'm not interested." Shut up. I had a silly view of the band Spirit, and it's funny how quickly we're talking about me. I used to see the album Taurus at every half-price book I ever flipped, every half-price bookstore who had a rack that I would flip through, and I'd see that, and I always thought, this is the coolest album cover ever.
It's not Spirit, though.
Who is that?
Taurus? That's ELP.
That's ELP.
Oh, it's Taurus. That's right. I'm getting it wrong. Tarkus, anyway, right? That's a great way to start. that is the coolest.
With the armadillo tank thing?
Yeah. It's really cool. And I thought that was a Spirit album this whole time. So,
sorry, Doug.
No.
You're learning a lot.
The story still works because I would always blow it off because I had a very superficial notion of this band. T.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to move away from me for as long as I can.
Okay.
Why did you pick this album that should have been mine?
Well,
it didn't last very long.
I think it was the last episode.
That was Aztec Camp.
Yeah, the Aztec. And you, I think you mentioned this, Doug, that when we started doing this podcast, we all sort of came up with a list of albums that we wanted to talk about. This was on my list. I wrote down, we've done a good chunk of the ones I wanted to. I'm not sure why it took so long to get to the Spirit album, but this was on my list of albums I want to talk about. Mainly because I'm not sure where this came from. I've had this album for a long time. I've known this album since I was in my late teens. My friend Pat Fry and I discovered them at the same time. He may have discovered Spirit and then introduced me to them. I don't really recall. But this was an album he and I listened to a lot. And we actually got to see them live in 90. Well, the incarnation of them in 90. They released an album at that time that got some airplay on the Dallas Fort Worth radio station where I grew up. And they used to have these free concerts at the west end of Dallas in this made up place called Dallas Alley, but it was just basically this big open place, and they would have concerts out there, and they had Roger McGuinn out there. I saw a lot of smaller name people, but I saw Kansas out there, and I since Spirit played when this album came out, and I got to see Randy California and Ed Cassidy and whoever else was with them. It wasn't anyone from this band than them. And the one thing I remember really about that, and I know I'm not talking about the album, but I just want to say this, is Ed Cassidy, the band, before they come on stage, you just hear this big boom, boom, boom. And Ed Cassidy had one of those big kettlebells, giant drums wrapped around like a
marching band?
Like a marching band, beating the hell out of it marching around the stage.
I would do that.
Yeah. And
I'd do that right now if I had
one. It was really, really kind of cool and funny, too. Because he's an odd-looking duck, that guy, Ed Cassidy.
And he does funny things like that all the time, apparently.
So I've liked this album for a long time. I like all four of the early incarnation Spirit albums a lot.
And this is the last one with the original lineup, number four.
This is the fourth album. It's the first one on Epic, because they were all on Ode Records, I think, before them. But it's just been in my DNA for a while. But it's one of those albums I don't pull out that often and listen to for some reason. And after listening to it for the podcast, because I really, really enjoyed reconnecting with it and getting to know it again, because it's great. I mean, everything about it's great. It's odd, but and you scratch your head going, why does this work?
Yeah,
but it does.
It does.
The vocals on it are great. The playing on it's great. The songs are great. We've talked about this before. I think it's sequenced really well. Although I may have a couple of quibbles about a couple of things, but I think it's sequenced really well. I like how it's all sort of interconnected with interludes and weird sound effects and stuff, so it sounds like one sort of solid piece of music.
It is cohesive.
Yeah, very cohesive.
And it is odd.
I do find it strange that so many people talk about it being a prog album, because there's some songs that are sort of that way, but Spirit never struck me as they get thrown
There's no Roman numerals.
There's a lot of labels that get thrown on them. Proto-metal. gets thrown on them a lot.
Psychedelic
maybe fits better
a
than
little
other
bit, but that's fairly superficial in my mind.
It well, is. I think the subject matter kind of makes it hippie sounding.
It is very hippie, very hippie, but that doesn't
nothing,
mean
say, nothing. Nothing says it ain't hippie. This is.
I'll tell you the two things that came that kind of jumped out at me listening to this album and the three before it when preparing for this podcast. One is I think this. You said this is the most. This is like the most Doug Cooper album that
Doug Cooper didn't pick.
Yeah. I think this is an absolute prime example of an album that straddles the 60s and the 70s, maybe better than any other album.
I agree with you on that.
It's got one foot planted in that whole hippie mentality, and then it sort of foreshadows the music that's going to come in the decade to follow.
That's so odd. I've got that in my notes.
The other thing is, I kept thinking, is this the American Traffic? Not so much on this album, because I think this album reins back on the jazzy stuff a little bit, but their first three albums, they sound a lot like that early Traffic early stuff, Traffic, where they're trying to interfuse.
More than the later Traffic with High Sparks.
It's this kind of jazzy interlude with this. Yeah. And then on this album, they introduce folk stuff, which Traffic, of course, did after. Mm-hmm.
Did that on
Barleycorn.
I mean, that may be a superficial thing, but I kept thinking that. But it's definitely an album that straddles the 60s and 70s better than any other album done, I think.
If you are a hippie out there, ladies and gentlemen, and this isn't in your collection, go find out what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Yes.
My dear friend who never told me about this album that got the award.
I just assumed you knew about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, hardly too.
Say, you know what they say about assuming.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a strange history with this album. Remember that IRS No Speak label?
Yes.
Okay. That didn't last very long, and it was basically a dumping ground.
We don't speak about it anymore.
Yeah.
Well, it had the guy that looked like a secret agent.
They had the IRS guy, but with a gag around his mouth. One of the first albums that they released was called Guitar Speak, and it was basically just a bunch of old guitar players. You know, Hank Marvin was on it, Robbie Krieger was on it, Leslie West was on it.
Of Mountain,
yeah. And I didn't really, to be honest with you, I didn't really like most of the songs on there. In fact, I even tried to return the album to Sound Warehouse and sent the Sound Warehouse guys.
But
no dice. But the song that I do remember liking off of it was the one by Randy California. And I've tried looking for it, and I haven't been able to find it.
You don't know
it.
What song it was?
I can't remember what the song is, but it was, and I should have brought my album out. But I just remember liking that. And then about, I guess it was in the mid-90s, somebody burned a copy of this CD for me. And it's one of the first, and I remember it because it was one of the first burned CDs I ever got. And I absolutely loved this album. And I you know, it's kind of like you. I mean, I fell in love with it. I was like, where have these guys been all my life? And I started reading up on them, and I figured, oh, Randy California is the guitar player. That's why I like this album so much. But kind of like you, I listened to it, and I just sort of put it on the back burner, and I've always kind of meant to listen to it again, but I just never have.
If you're one of the people out there who has not listened to this album, you need to change that immediately. I don't know how big the list would have to be for this to be one of your essentials in your album collection. But it wouldn't be that big. Not that big of a record collection, especially if you like that period of time with music.
It's definitely an album that has grown in terms of its importance from when it was released.
Well, it didn't do very well compared to other Spirit albums.
Yeah, this was the least selling album of their
collection. And I think it got, you know, it was one of those albums that got mixed critical reviews. But it continued to sell steadily, maybe not a lot, but steadily. And then people started reassessing. You know, people.
Yeah. Well, if you just look at the, all of us probably read a lot of reviews, and I probably read more reviews about this album than other albums I researched, and nobody had nothing lower than 4.
Yeah. You know? So I saw a B, like I don't know.
Yeah. Well.
That may be my wife. She's not a fan for some reason, but
well, I'm sure my wife would hate it, but that would go for every album we reviewed, I think. Maybe not Ray Charles. The other thing I think is important is Spirit's generally known by everybody for one thing.
Randy California.
No. Oh. They're known for the controversy surrounding
the Zeppelin
Stairway to Heaven.
Stairway to Heaven, yeah.
So, and I want to get the other thing just taken care of real quickly, because I do want people to have an idea. This reminds me a little bit of Badfinger. Everybody knows the songs, but a lot of people don't know the band. Yeah. So they do have a hit that I'm pretty sure everybody is going to know. And that hit is?
But before you play that, I've got a line on you.
Not called before.
No, I got a line on you. But before you play that, I think it's also pretty fundamental to say that this is not a band you can pigeonhole. You're going to hear, I got a line on you. And while they do revisit that, that is not their sound.
No,
I don't know what their sound is. It's one of their many of their sounds.
Yeah. It would be like play one key on the piano and assume all the keys sound that.
And just real quick, that's another reason that I was attracted to this band is because you're constantly on your toes listening to this band.
The album that we're talking about tonight is very, very, I mean, there's a lot of variety on it.
But it's cohesive, too.
It's cohesive, right.
Anyway, I didn't mean to take you away from playing.
We've crossed this territory again with a cohesive album that takes you by surprise on every song, and it's a great combination. We found it with some others. But here is their hit, one of their hits, their hittest hit. That's a hit, fellas.
Yeah, it was it's off of their album, The Family That Plays Together, which is released in 68. And that was, I think it hit number 25 on the Billboard charts.
Blackfoot covered it.
Yeah.
Alice Cooper.
No relation. So, yeah, and people have heard that song. And like I said before, the thing you got to realize is that's just a small bit of what this band can do and what they sound like. If you think, oh, I don't particularly care for that, that's not what I want to listen to, you're not going to get that if you listen to Spirit.
I think that's one of the things that kind of makes them difficult to have a fan base, because they are so different. Every, you know, their album, even within their albums, there's so much variety.
You would have to be one of those people that wants a little bit of everything from the buffet, not someone who just sits down and eats a plate of ribs and doesn't look at anything else.
The nice thing about this band is that you get a little bit from the buffet, but it's all pretty decent.
It's all good.
I'm gonna push most buffets. Yeah, I'm going to push this aside because it's a bit rank. It's unlike the Golden Corral,
where it's all about quantity and not quality.
It's more like one of those big meat carving buffets.
Yeah, all the handicapped parking's not used up because of the people that eat for fun that come at 11 and stay till 2.
Yeah.
The other thing that this band is very famous for is the controversy over Stairway to Heaven. And Tony's going to tell us a little bit about that.
After Randy California died, the estate of Randy California sued Led Zeppelin, saying that they basically stole the opening bit of guitar work from Spirit song Taurus. They said they dropped the lawsuit if Zeppelin acknowledged Randy California in the songwriting credits and then paid all the back royalties due to his estate because of that. Zeppelin ended up winning the lawsuit overall. And there's been some... well, let's play it first, and then we'll talk to that about that day. Most people say that's a little similar. We've talked about this guy before, Rick Beato, who's a very, very knowledgeable musician and just commentator on music.
He's a lot like us, except he knows what he's talking
about. Yeah, and his YouTube channel is fantastic if you haven't been on it. We've recommended before, he's great. But he's he says that this is it's not a copy, that there's plenty of different songs that have the same chord progression, and that it's not that unusual, and that Zeppelin did not steal it. Now, there's a couple of reasons why I maybe disagree with that universal discounting of that. One is Spirit toured with Zeppelin on the tour supporting their Spirit's debut album. They opened for Spirit on that. During that tour, they did a medley, and in that they also included the Spirit song Fresh Garbage in their medley. So Zeppelin was playing the Spirit song Fresh Garbage off of Spirit's debut. So at one point, I think somebody in Zeppelin said they'd never heard the song Taurus, but it's odd to say that when you're playing a song off the same album.
Yeah.
Number two, Randy California used to have a theremin on his amp, and he would play through it, do weird things with it, and Jimmy Page adopted that later, so there's that as well. Yeah. And then there's a lot of stories about how influential Ed Cassidy was on John Bonham's playing. There's a point in Spirit songs where Ed Cassidy would play. His drum set, it was interesting. He had these big, giant
kettle drums
or something on either side of, and he used them as toms on either side of his drum kit. Huge, huge drums. And in part of his solo, he'd play those with his hands. And he beat the hell out of them. And that supposedly had an influence on Bonham and his playing.
Who also, they're in it in the middle of Moby Dick, where he throws the sticks away.
And so there you go. And then, of course, Doug, what else does Zeppelin have going for it that might lead people to say that there could be some truth to this?
Well, a lot of people that this is Vinyl Tap consider Led Zeppelin to be England's greatest cover band. And if you're an American blues artist, there's a 35% chance that you had an album or a song ripped off by Led Zeppelin.
I think there's probably some truth that there are a lot of songs you support this particular chord progression.
Dazed and Confused was another one.
But maybe not quite like this. But I think, like I said, to just ultimately dismiss it that, there's no way Zeppelin could have done that is nonsense.
Yeah.
They've done it lots and lots.
You know, it's weird.
Zeppelin got nailed so many times, they'd be crazy not to try.
Yeah. I remember the first time when I heard about the controversy, I found Taurus and I listened to it, and I remember thinking, man, this doesn't sound like Stairway to Heaven. But now I'm listening to it going, totally sounds like Stairway to Heaven.
It is. It's not crazy uncommon to have a walk down to A minor like this, but it's the part of the neck where it's played, and it's
the pace.
If someone were to tell me that he had never heard it before and it had no influence on him, I'd be unlikely to believe anything else the guy said. He'd all say, I'm in this band called Led Zeppelin. I'd go, right, whatever. Anyway, so those are two things for which this band is well known. I have a new feature that I want to bring up at this time. It's called A Declaration from Doug. And I'm declaring this the most interesting band we have talked about because of so many things. And we're about to go to tea here and find out a little bit more about the background of this band. But every time I did a little research on this band, something else would surprise me, and I would just laugh out loud and say, that's crazy. That's funny. That's a surprise.
Yeah.
So this band is filled with surprises. Tea?
Yes, Doug.
Where'd these guys come from?
Come from California. Mm-hmm. I may not have tapped on everything you came up with, so please
are you encouraging me to say something?
Yes, I am.
I'll try to break through my shyness.
One of the things we got to talk about is the drummer and his relationship to the guitarist.
Well, I was going to start with Ed Cassidy, because I think he's the oldest member of the band, and I think it's worth
quite a bit.
Yeah, but it's worth starting with him because he's got a pretty interesting history. So, he was born in Harvey, Illinois, which is a rural suburb of Chicago, in 1923. So he's 20 years plus older than most of the guys in the band when the band starts. As a youngster, he moves to Bakersfield when he's six. He takes up drumming, and he's good enough at the age of 12 to be considered a professional. This is around 1937. He's playing for a myriad of blues musicians towards the end of the 30s. By the 40s, he switched to playing jazz with big bands. World War II comes along, and he ends up joining the Navy. After the war, he moves back to Bakersfield, and he works a bunch of different jobs, a salesman, cab driver, swimming pool serviceman, aircraft mechanic, and then he settles into being a professional drummer. And during that time, he's playing drums with Dixieland bands, country and western bands, polka bands, Latin bands. He even worked on film soundtracks, and at one point with the San Francisco Opera. So this is a guy who's got a pretty good pedigree.
Yeah.
Legend has it, at one point during this time, he played, listen to this, he played 282 back-to-back one-night stands over 17 states. Jeez. I mean, I don't know how you.
That's a lot of practice. Like that. Yeah. He got his 1,000 hours or 10,000 hours.
Yeah. By the 50s, by 1950, he's like, that's kind of lost its appeal, and you can see why. So he enrolls in college, and he's going to be a music teacher. Well, that doesn't last very long either. And a year later, in 51, he quits, and he moves down the coast to Los Angeles, where he could start working as a jazz drummer regularly with other musicians. And he's a jazz drummer. He's playing jazz on with Cannonball Adderley, Thelonious Monk, Roland Kirk, Jerry Mulligan, Dexter Gordon, Chet Baker. This is just a few people he played with, which is pretty impressive. In 1964, something happens that we talked about in a previous episode.
Yeah, baby. Yeah.
Crazy.
This is a song Led Zeppelin did not copy
that we know of. Hey, Doug, what does that music mean?
That means it's time for Connections, ladies and gentlemen. That's one of the highlights of our podcast. And thank you for all the people that wrote in saying they like the Connections part of the show. We'll hope that you'll play with us. We're going to try to connect this album and this band. Oh, sure. Yeah, I forgot that word. We're going to try to connect them to previous podcasts, and there's some fun ones on here. I'm going to go first to Jonathan J.M. Rowe to see if he has a connection.
Well, I'm just going to go with the obvious one. The producer is David Briggs, and we've talked about a different David Briggs before, but this is not the keyboard.
This isn't the different one.
This is a different one.
This is the same one.
No, this is a different one.
This is a different one than that one, but a same one as another one.
The same one as another one. That is correct. The producer is David Briggs, and he has worked with Neil Young. So he's worked a lot with Neil Young. He was especially during the Crazy Horse days.
Neil Young.
No, what was the album that we did? Not the album we did, but the one that was...
Harvest?
Didn't he produce Harvest?
I don't think Harvest Moon.
Talked about Harvest Moon, but he...
After the Gold Rush, maybe?
Yeah, he did after
the Gold Rush. He did a bunch.
Yeah, okay. He did. Russ Never Sleeps, even. So.
Okay.
So, there's a connection. T?
Yeah, let's...
You probably won't have one like Neil Young, which gets us a lot of... ladies and gentlemen, Spotify has a lot of people that accidentally bump into our podcast because of Neil Young. They're trying to figure out if he's still boycotting them or not.
In 64, Ed Cassidy joins a group called the Rising Suns. And what we mentioned, the episode we mentioned that on previously was on the Ry Cooter episode, because the Rising Suns were Taj Mahal, Ry Cooter, and Ed Cassidy. And they go into the studio actually to record an album. It was going to be produced by Terry Melcher, but they only released a single. But yeah, he was involved with Ry Cooter.
Yeah. Paradise and Lunch.
Yeah. So,
married man, a fool to think his wife loved nobody but him. Anyway, I need to listen to that Taj Mahal Ry Cooter album. That sounds like that would be a match made in heaven. I'm going to bring up Lou Adler. Okay. We encountered him. I think we've encountered him with Linda Ronstadt and with Love.
Yeah.
He's the one that was highly offended that Love had to go play instead of sit there and talk to him. And he took their name away from them. They were the Grassroots, and he said, I'm going to do this other Grassroots band, and no one's going to ever know about you.
He's one of those guys you read about that had, for lack of any better term, he was like a muscle. He would bully people around.
Yeah. He was one of the driving forces behind the Monterey Pop Festival.
Yeah, absolutely. Spirit signed with his label. We'll get that later. Signed with his label right before that festival. Oddly enough, they're not on it. They're not playing the Monterey Pop Festival.
And they missed another one.
Yeah, they missed a big one.
Some of y'all heard this other one.
Yeah.
Any more connections, fellas?
Yes. The Birds. In particular, Sweetheart of the Rodeo. I'm going to mention
Cassidy
that.
Cassidy plays on that? Or?
No. And this is one of those connections where we connect loosely, whatever. Okay. But So Randy California grew up. His uncle ran a club in L.A. that a lot of musicians played in, and we'll get to that club when we talk a little bit more about the history, because I can't find it in my notes right now. But because of that, he was around a lot of musicians. So when Randy was young, he it was the Ashgrove was where he was. Ashgrove.
Okay. Yeah.
He was surrounded by musicians. He took free guitar lessons from blues musicians Mance Lipscomb and Sleepy John Etz, but he took official, like paid for guitar lessons from Clarence White. When Clarence White was with the
Birds?
No, when he was with the Kentucky Colonels. And Clarence White plays on the Sweetheart of the Rodeo, the B Bender.
The B Bender, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The old B Bender. I remember that.
Again, a loose connection. When after the band broke up, they actually got back together in 1984 and released an album called The 13th Dream, which was it was all the original members. Mm-hmm. It was a weird album because it was essentially they re-recorded, I think, seven tracks and added three new ones.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring that up is Bob Walsh played on that album. Bob Welch played on the
Fleetwood Mac album
we talked about, Bare Trees.
And there's a video of him playing in one of these super jams that Randy California put together.
There you go.
On a program called YouTube.
It sounds like they tried to update their sound for the 80s. It really does kind of have a... it's got hair metal production, I guess.
They kind of slipped into that a little bit in the 80s. But what's interesting is that I believe it's Ferguson that said that none of the old magic was. He's not sure why they did it, because none of the old magic was there to re-record those songs, and they just didn't.
It didn't do very well.
I would think it would be very hard to reproduce some of these things here. Yep. Anyway, so that's Ed Cassidy. Took us into Connections.
So let's
quite an accomplished drummer.
Let's slide back into him a little bit. So
was his hair like?
Well, he shaved his head, mm-hmm. and he wore all black, and he had the nickname. I don't know if the guys in Spirit gave it to him. I'm assuming they did. But he played in an incarnation of a band earlier with some of the guys in this band called the Red Roosters. And the Red Roosters have Ed Cassidy in it, but it has three other future members of Spirit who we'll get to as we talk through this. It had Ed Cassidy's 14-year-old stepson, Randy California. He was not known as Randy California. Then he was known as Randy Craig Wolf. Mm-hmm. The 17-year-old bassist, Mark Andes, who is also on the album we're talking about tonight, and an 18-year-old singer named Jay Ferguson. And interestingly enough, Ferguson and Andes were high school buddies. They met Randy California, or Randy at the time, Randy Wolf, at a folk music camp in the mountains outside of Los Angeles, and all three of them just hit it off musically, so it was a no-brainer they were going to start a band. Also in that band was this guitarist named Mike Fondelier. I think that's how you pronounce it. Hmm. They actually played, the Red Roosters played at the Ashgrove, which was, as I mentioned, Randy California's uncle's club. And a lot, you know, what was cool about that club was after hours, the Birds would show up, Buffalo Spring would show up, the Doors would show up. it was L.A. after all. Yeah. And they were essentially a folk rock act where Randy California would play these Chuck Berry double leads over these folk rock kind of foundations that the rest of the band laid down, and they would do some old blues tunes, and they occasionally do originals that Ferguson and Fondelier wrote. The Red Roosters were around for a little bit over a year. They broke up in 1966 when Ed Cassidy got a gig playing drums in New York at a string of jazz concerts, and Cassidy moves his family up there, which of course includes young Randy, which leaves the Red Roosters minus two players. So the Red Roosters end up breaking up. So I think that's a good place to switch to Randy California. So he was born, as I mentioned, Randy Craig Wolf in 1941 in Los Angeles to a music-loving family. He starts playing guitar at a young age. I've already talked about who he took lessons from, which is pretty great.
Yeah.
So when he's in New York, they're living on Long Island. Randy's 15 years old. One day he takes the subway into town and he goes to this place called Manny's Music Store.
Famous Manny's, yeah.
We've been there before. That should have been a connection.
Yeah. Was it? Where have we been there before?
I can't remember. May have been Mark Knopfler went in there and got a guitar from someone.
Mark Knopfler, everybody talks about that record store or that music store.
What happened when he's in there that day is he notices this guy in the back playing a Stratocaster. and he's pretty good. So Randy, who by all accounts was not shy about talking to anybody, walks up to this guy and their eyes catch first, and then he goes up to the guy and says, "Hey, can I show you some things I've learned on the guitar?" The guy obliges, gives him the car. Randy starts playing slide on the guitar, and the guy's like, "Hey, you're pretty good. Why don't you? I've got a gig at this place called Cafe Wa in Greenwich Village. Why don't you come down here and sit in with us?" Who was that guy? That guy, other guitar player.
That man was Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, the idea of walking up to Jimmy and saying, "Let me show you something." Yeah. I bet very few people can say that. Yeah. That may be on my death. That would be on my burial stone if I had done that.
Yeah. How many people? Sure. How many people could say that and then impress him enough to say, "Hey, why don't you come and sit down with me?" So he goes down there. The band is called Jimmy James and the Blue Flames. Manny Roth, who is, I'm assuming the guy who owns Manny's music store, says to Hendrix, "That kid's dynamic. You got to get, good job. You got to get him playing with you." So that was one of the things that pushed him to do it. Hendrix asks him the night he shows up to play to join his band. And so during the next month, he plays with Jimmy James and the Blue Flames for 3 months, five sets a night, every night of the week, except for Sunday. So he's learning from this. Hendrix is the one who gave him the name Randy California, because there was another guy in the band named Randy Palmer who was from Texas, and Hendrix didn't want everybody to be confused. So Randy Wolf was Randy California, and Randy Palmer ends up being Randy Texas. And so that's where they got the name. And I guess when you're given a name for Jimi Hendrix,
it sticks.
You stick with it.
Right? Yep. I'd keep it. Unless it was California.
Yeah. So
I'd take Texas any day. Yeah. I may just do that.
Johnny Texas is... Hey, there's a book called Johnny Texas.
So word starts to spread about this Jimmy... what I was going to say is that Randy California says that once he left the band, he still didn't know his name was Jimi Hendrix. He thought his name was Jimmy James. He thought that for a long time before Hendrix became famous. Anyway, word starts to spread. People start coming down to see the band play, including people like Keith Richards and Chaz Chandler from The Animals. At this time, Chaz Chandler's... he was the bassist for the Animals. He's a manager and a producer at the time. Mm-hmm. And he convinces Hendrix, "You need to come to England with me. You're going to be huge. You need
Keith Richards is there because he's got his white Strat. Keith Richards' girlfriend gave
Jimi Hendrix his white Strat.
And he wanted to, "Who's playing my guitar?"
Oh, I didn't know that. That's pretty funny.
Anyway, I think Hendrix is good enough, though, to go see anyway.
I didn't know that.
And he was teaching Randy California we got this one called Wild Thing. Yeah. And this one called Hey Joe.
Yeah, Hey Joe, he played. A Rolling Stone was also, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, all those you can hear Hendrix play.
Well, and by all accounts,
he does pretty good with Dylan covers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, Hendrix is convinced he's going to go to the UK, and he actually invites, he wants to keep his band together, and he invites Randy California to go along with him. But Randy California is 15 years old.
And his mom and dad say,
"He ain't going. He ain't going.
I think that's a good decision.
Yeah, I think so too. Anyway, once Ed Cassidy's gigs are done, they end up moving back to California. Ferguson and Andy's had formed a garage rock band called Western Union, which I love that name for a band.
That's a pretty cool name.
After Cassidy had moved his family to New York, they'd almost gotten a recording contract, but they didn't. And when they didn't, they broke up. I'm going to give just a slight background, a little bigger background on both. So Jay Ferguson was raised also in a musical family. He starts playing the piano at 12 years old. At 16, he got into the banjo. And prior to joining the Red Roosters, he started a bluegrass band with his brother, Tom, called the Oak Hill Stump Straddlers. So, knew his way around some instruments. Mark Andes is the son of character actor Keith Andes. He's been in a whole lot of stuff. I'm not going to list it all. But after the demise of Western Union, Andes actually played bass for a short period of time with Canned Heat before they got a record
deal.
That
guy's been in a lot of bands.
He has. For some reason, he gets invited, while he's with Canned Heat, he gets invited to play with this band called Yellow Balloon. Have you guys ever heard of them?
No.
No, me neither. They had a single at the time, so it was, a little bit more lucrative of a deal, but that didn't work out. And he says, I can't believe I left Canned Heat to go with Yellow Balloon, but I think it worked out for him in general, because he ends up getting with Spirit. Why are we experts?
We're expert on that because Mark Andes actually moved to Texas and resided in Austin for a good while and played with some local bands here, including including the Bump Band.
The Bump Band, Ian McLagan from the Faces.
Small Faces and the Faces. Yeah.
And he also, I think, played with Alejandro Escovedo.
He played with Alejandro. And so he did some stints here.
Alfred Milligan, too.
Yeah. Yeah, he did play with him. Yeah. So, but before that, he was, before he moved here, he was in other bands. He was in Firefall.
Yeah, you want to briefly talk about Firefall?
Well, here we get into the yacht rock part of the intro.
Yeah, this is very...
This is where...
Yacht rock.
My research, I kept going, whoa, because of all of these connections with other... Go ahead, tell us about Firefall, Jim.
Well, Firefall is they were... Kind of, we're yacht rock. They brought in...
They wanted to be like Poco or something.
Yeah, they really did kind of... And they got pretty close to it. But they had a lot... They're flute-based and they had I guess their big song was Just Remember I Love You and It'll Be All Right.
Just remember I love you and it'll be all right.
But yeah, and then there's a strange way to tell me you love me, and so I think he left Firefall and then joined Heart at just about the perfect time to join Heart, not musically but commercially.
Yeah. This is not the Steamboat Annie Heart.
No, this is the synthesizer Peter Wolf produced Heart. You know, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of good Heart out there anyway.
I agree with you 100%. But
this is especially egregious
Heart. This is bad.
This is an interconnection.
Yeah.
You remember they covered Stairway to Heaven.
And Rock and Roll.
At the Albert Hall.
Oh, Royal Albert
Hall. They played Paige and
Plant
are up in the car. It's amazing. It's awesome. It's just, I have to wipe it here. And the other guy's a yacht rocker. And for a long time, I've liked this song and have never been able to talk about it before. But now that I know he was part of Spirit, I feel a little brave. And I want to share this with everyone. Thunder Island, Jay Ferguson.
Well, let's also, before we forget, because I know we will forget, this goes way in advance, but Jay Ferguson wrote the theme song to the American version of The Office.
Another one that made me go, wow!
Probably more people have heard that than most of the songs on this album.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. So.
And that's the connection that show has with rock. You, of course, Creed was from Grassroots,
yeah,
which was managed by... Adler. I thought it blew my mind to find out Creed was actually Creed from Grassroots.
Funny. Anyway, they end up when Cassidy and Randy California moved back to California. Ferguson and Andy's are available, so they end up hooking up with them again. One thing everybody noticed immediately was that Randy California's guitar playing changed after sitting in with Andrew for a little while.
Imagine that.
He's no longer playing these Chuck Berry riffs. He's doing much more interesting things. The band also added a jazz pal of Cassidy's, keyboardist named John Locke. And I want to talk about him because he's interesting as well, too. He was a friend of Robbie Krieger, who was the Doors guitarist, but we will not hold that against him. He was involved in the whole sort of West Coast acid culture, living with a bunch of hippies in Topanga. He eventually kicks the hippies out and has some of the guys from the band move in. The house is known as the Yellow House. That's what his house was known as. There was another guy living in the house at the same time, a guy by the name of Barry Hanson. Do you know who that is?
No.
Dr. Demento.
Oh, really?
Yeah. For those of you who don't know who Dr. Demento is, he was a disc jockey who had his own show, and he played novelty songs and other things. Big Zeppelin, or not Zeppelin, Big Zappa fan. Anyway.
Didn't he do things like Weird Al?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Weird Al.
Some kind of stuff like that.
No, he got Weird Al like very popular because he played him on his show.
And that was like a Sunday night deal.
Yeah, syndicated.
King Biscuit Flower
Dr.
Hour.
Dr. Demento show.
Yeah. Dr. Demento I used show. To really like
Everybody that. Listened to that yeah. at our, who's our age. Anyway, it was he knew all these guys when they were in the Red Roosters. Here's another interesting thing. He was a roadie for Spirit. He was a roadie for Canned Heat. When they go into the studio to start recording demos, he produces their first demos, Dr. Demento.
What's he called at this period of time?
Barry Hanson. Yeah, so this new five-piece loses the Red Rooster's name, and they christen themselves Spirits Rebellious, and that is after...
It's some book, right?
Yeah, Cahill.
What's that?
Oh, by the guy who did The Prophet.
The Prophet, one of the number one selling books.
Yeah,
It was a collection of short stories by him. Yeah. Called and Spirits and
Pims. Anyone wanting to be deep and spiritual, you can save yourself a lot of trouble just buy that book and throw it on your coffee table.
Which one, The Prophet?
Oh, yeah.
That's what my English teacher in high school said. If you ever want to impress your English professor in college, just walk in with that book. Yeah,
I feel that way when you want to look like you're a deep but troubled individual, but like deep, you walk around with a stupid copy of Catcher in the Rye with you too. So
yeah, and listen to The Cure.
Anywho,
And yet,
so evidently this band was really something live. Ferguson says they had a really dramatic show. California was like a wizard on stage. He had all these special effects at his feet. He dressed in furs and silks. Ed Cassidy was impossible to ignore because he had his shaved head were all black and he had those big drums on either side of his kit. Yeah. And it just was just crazy. And he played those with bare hands. And evidently Locke was crazy on the keyboards.
Yeah. And he also was famous for a number of political essays.
You know, he used to tell people he was related to John Locke, but
I would too.
I don't think
he wrote an essay concerning human understanding. And
that's where we got the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, it's very influential on our founders. And
no, the Declaration of Independence.
We don't have to pay attention to him because he's dead white male.
Anyway, moving along from that, their manager gets them studio time at New Western Recorders. You know where what was recorded there? Good Vibrations was recorded.
Oh, I did not.
To record those demos with Dr. Demento, Barry Dr. Demento Hanson.
That's hilarious.
They shorten their name from Spirits Rebellious to Spirit. They shop these demos around. A guy named Brian Barry hears them because they weren't really going anywhere. Brian Barry is doing A&R for Lou Adler. And Adler, we've talked about him before, but he was a film and record producer, and he was co-owner. I didn't know this. He's co-owner of the Roxy.
Oh, yeah. Helped build ABC Records. I guess he's not the A in ABC
Records. I thought that was America.
Yeah, that is America. Yeah, he sold it in 1971.
Okay.
So,
well, there you go.
ABC, so it's not like Albert being the A and
yeah,
A&M.
He's not like the A. Okay. I was getting Herb Albert and Lou Adler confused.
So, he had recently formed Ode Records, and the band auditioned for Adler at the Whiskey A Go Go. I'm not sure why they didn't audition for him at the Roxy, but who knows. He dug him, and based on the success that Adler had with other musicians, Spirit decides to sign with the label. And a week before the Monterey Pop Festival, as we mentioned, they sign with them, and they're not on Monterey Pop Festival. So they begin recording their debut in 1967, and we talked briefly about it. It's it's just called Spirit. It's released in 68. Adler produces it. He produces their next three albums. This album's kind of a sign of things to come. It's essentially a psychedelic rock album, but it's got a kind of a heavy jazz sheen to it.
Kind of got like a Blue Cheer sound to it, I guess.
Yeah. Jay Ferguson is primarily the songwriter on this particular album, with the exception of songs like Taurus, which are Randy California. The band, this is a story we've heard before, the band isn't happy with the end result. The reason why was Adler had hired this guy named Marty Paich to orchestrate the album. He puts orchestration all over the songs, and they felt it fundamentally changed what they were going for. In fact, Randy California was so livid, he said he didn't mind this guy so much because he'd worked with some good people like Sinatra and stuff, but it just absolutely neutered their sound.
I think putting strings on a Sinatra album and a Spirit album might be two different things.
Yeah.
So just me.
But then the other thing is the guy didn't come cheap, so they had to pay for this guy to come in, even though they didn't want to
ruin their record.
Despite all this, the album's a minor hit. It reaches number 31 on the Billboard 200, and it stays on the chart for 7 months. Yeah. So, second album, Family That Plays Together, also released in 68. Again, we've talked about how that was not uncommon back in the early days of rock and roll. You knock things out, you know? So, the second album is where the jazz psych fusion thing really starts to get together better. It's loud guitars, bluesy licks, all these little jazzy interludes. And this is the album I was listening to where the Traffic thing really hit. In fact, there's a California Lock co-written song called It Shall Be that if you listen to it, it's like, oh, yeah, that sounds like Traffic. And that's the album that has I Got a Line on You. Their third album, Clear, is a bit of a mess, and there's a reason behind that. While they were recording The Family That Plays Together, they were asked to record a soundtrack for French director's film, the French director Jacques Demy, his film Model Shop. He came to L.A. He came to L.A. looking for like an acid rock group. He saw Spirit at the Whiskey A Go-Go. The problem was Demi's wife had told him, go see the Doors, but he had dropped a hit of acid with his driver and went to the wrong place and saw Spirit instead. So he asked them to do the music for the band or for the film.
That's hilarious.
Gotta be careful with that stuff, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. That album, the soundtrack was unavailable for a long time. It was released eventually, but because it wasn't going to be available when they were working on their third album, they ended up pulling stuff from that soundtrack and recording some other stuff and released this album Clear. It's really because of that, it doesn't really hold very well together. It's a compromise album, essentially, of various different things. It's released in 1969. It peaks at number 55
on the charts. I believe that's the one they were supporting with a tour when Lou Adler thought that they would be too busy on their tour to open up for Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock.
You are correct.
Yeah.
And I just want to ask you two, y'all studied rock and roll music. Is that a good plan?
How many bands have we talked about that missing Woodstock put a dent in their career?
It happens a lot.
I mean, the biggest one I think we talked about was the Kinks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they missed a lot.
Yeah.
Because they were punch people.
They were boycotted.
But to get in front of Jimmy at that show, I mean, he was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know that he was the highest paid performer at Woodstock. I think he was also highest paid at Monterey. So he must have had a good time slot. And to be right before Jimmy, I can't imagine what would have happened to their. Yeah. And I've never seen this band live, but I would imagine this is one very fun band to see live.
Yeah, and probably tight as all get out, too, yeah. I bet. And you know, one thing we didn't mention is how supportive Hendrix was. There's a picture I'll post on the website of him being interviewed around this time in 68 on a Cleveland radio program, and he's holding Spirit's debut album in his hand. So, you know, he obviously had fondness for this
band. The work I did getting ready for this album made me really like Hendrix more than I did before, which is good because he's coming up soon.
He is. We're going to have a very, very quick turnaround connection. Anyway, they also played a few dates, I think opening at this point for Zeppelin. I think Zeppelin opened for them on their first album, but by this point, Zeppelin had eclipsed them in terms of popularity, I believe, or maybe they played some festivals with them, something along those lines. Anyway, they did play the Atlanta Pop Festival, which by all accounts, they knocked it out of the park. Before we get into the album we're talking about, they did release a song, a single, self-produced single, after they released Clear and before the 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus, called 1984.
Plastic eyeballs.
Was that in the pocket?
It's an interesting song because it's one of the few Spirit songs from this time period I don't particularly like.
I'm not a real big fan of it. I tried to, it came up often when I was just shuffling songs by Spirit. And yeah. It just didn't really do that much for me. It sounds like it's very ode to hippiedom. And
it hit number 69 on the Billboard charts in February of 70. So yeah. Anyway, that essentially brings us up to where we are. I do want to say, and I'm imagining it. I was trying to find, so they leave Ode and they sign with Epic before the 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus is mm-hmm. released. They end up recording it for Epic.
And they split with Lou Adler.
I'm guessing a lot of that had to do with the Woodstocky thing. I don't know. I couldn't find any reason why they split with him, but my guess is that's the case. And it opens them up for another person to produce.
JM, who produced the new album?
That was David Briggs.
Neil Young.
From Neil Young fame.
Then we got this record cover, which I think a lot of the times when albums get called psychedelic, it's because of the cover. And this album is definitely trying to be psychedelic looking. It does not look like someone who's going to write Thunder Island or play with Heart has anything to do with this.
Well, so this was done, the cover and the photographs on the inside, I don't know about the back cover, but the front, it's a gatefold, the front cover and the photos on the inside were done by a poet, photographer, and filmmaker by the name of Ira Cohen. And what he had done is in his studio, he hung these big reflexive Mylar film things mm-hmm. on hinge boards on his walls and his ceilings. And he would invite people to come in and experience the space, and he would take pictures of them. So he's got pictures of Hendrix in there and a bunch of other famous musicians. And that is what you're seeing on the cover of the Spirit album, what you're seeing on the inside are the camera pointing at the Mylar reflecting the band. The band on that. And of course, they're all gussied up and weirdo. What's interesting, again, talking about this being an album that straddles both decades, this cover does not look like it was released in 1970. It looks 3 years earlier than that, easily. Yeah,
it does. And what's weird about it is the border around the picture is so fat. You would think they would use the whole cover for the pictures, but. And then the back cover's got somebody passed out with bottles around him. So I bet Mama was happy to see him.
Well, the guy who did the art direction for the album, not take the pictures, was the John Locke.
Really?
Yeah, he's the one who kind of put the packaging together.
Maybe that's John Locke on the back. Who knows? One of the...
probably someone he doesn't like on the back.
One of the things I did want to mention about Briggs is the reason this album, I think, one of the reasons it sounds so cohesive is because of him. Because by all accounts from the band, he reined in some of their more like jammy things.
Not a whole lot of jammy on this.
But this album was less jammy and less, a little more disciplined and pop oriented than maybe some of the earlier things.
Yeah.
And it pays off. At this time, ladies and gentlemen, we usually like to get into the actual album we're talking about after having progressed over all kinds of other territories. We're going to start out with a song called Prelude - Nothing to Hide.
I know you're asleep, wake up.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. That was me exercising enormous self-control and stopping. We heard just a little bit of Prelude, and then we got to the point where it really kicks it in, and we go into Nothing to Hide. Tony, is this an acceptable way to begin an album?
Oh, my God. This is a fantastic way to start this album. And it's essentially three songs in one, because even after Nothing to Hide, it slides into a different thing.
Yep.
That prelude is so fantastic, and then it just kicks into the song.
It does set up what comes right after it
perfectly.
It's a perfect, I mean, again, you can't pigeonhole this band because they play all sorts of different stuff, but this gives you an idea, kind of. I mean, not like other things where like, oh, this is like, but it, you get an idea that, oh, yeah, you're in for a bit of a ride.
It's just, it's like, if you listen to the first part of it, I mean, I could see myself just, oh boy, this is just going to be some, so, you know, hippie folk album. And then it goes into that, you know, just to, like, what is it, about 45 seconds of that little strum. And how they came up with that is just, I have no idea how they did that.
This does not sound like a designed album to me.
Yeah.
This sounds like,
it just happened.
Dude, listen to this. And then, dude, oh yeah. And one thing you can tell is the drums are really important to this band. Yeah. And
I like how they're never overpowering.
They do some amazing stuff.
I think they help discipline this. I don't think this is a very disciplined album. And I love that.
Yeah.
And I tried to come up with one adverb for this record, and it is exuberant.
Yeah.
I think if someone's not having fun while they're making this record, they're faking it really well.
Yeah. Well, and then just getting into that third part. You know, first of all, I have no idea what this song's about. I don't really care.
It's great. I think it says "Call for us to wake up."
After Ferguson screams "All right," and it gets into that last part where the horns kick in, that groove comes on, the horns kick in, and Grandy California's playing those weird spacey sounds over it.
Yeah,
I could listen. It's way too short. I could listen to that for another 5 minutes.
Oh, it's great. It's a great headphone album. That last part is a great thing to listen to.
Oh, because things are sliding back and forth.
We're still in the time where people think it's cool to play balance.
Yeah.
Which
things back and forth.
That, for me, that's, I get a little sentimental when I hear that.
Well, but it was such an easy thing to do with stereo. Oh, we're going to make a stereo? Oh, we'll make it go from one ear to the other.
Well, you know, one of the reasons why they did that was because panning wasn't invented until like the late 60s. So it used to just be, it had to be on one side or the other or in the middle. But then they figured out that they could actually, you could.
And once they figured it out, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, and I always found it funny bringing up Zeppelin again. They would record songs where they would have half of the band in one on one side and half of the band in the other side. If you blew out one of your speakers or something,
if you listen to Beatles where they only have one track playing,
or listen to the first Van Halen album, that up for a fact because my buddy had a.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a chance, please look up David Lee Roth isolated vocals on Running with the Devil. You will. I promise you, you won't watch it once, and I promise you, you will laugh hard. So, speaking of great music, so this is a good tune, and I'm with Tony. I think a lot of these songs are about things that would make me roll my eyes, but I'm immediately put into a mood of not caring at all, and I give these guys a complete pass on all of that.
Well, the lyric, don't spend a lot of time reading.
Well, the lyrics, you know, this is an album that Randy California wrote most of the stuff on. I think maybe three songs he didn't, and he co-wrote maybe one with somebody else. He is knee-deep in the hippie philosophy
stuff. Yeah.
All of his lyrics are very much peace and love and, you know.
And the environment.
Yeah. And it's...
Well, he was a big-time surfer.
Yeah. And if you get too much in the weeds in that, it sounds very dated. Mm-hmm. If you can just kind of understand the lyrics as something else and listen to music, I don't think this album sounds dated at all. But that's just me.
I don't think the album sounds dated. I think the sentiment is...
Yes, definitely.
Yes, but not the... Not the sound.
Well, I think there's things it can say to us now. Anyway.
Speaking of which.
a little lecture. this song is one I think most people have heard. Mm-hmm. And it really cracks me up.
It's one that's been covered as well.
By a lot of people. Mm-hmm. 14 times, I think.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
It's nature's way.
I love
It's another great song.
I love the drums in it.
I love
too.
The, you know, those timpani boom, drums. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just I've got that a question. Rim shot. Yeah.
Was there a cowbell in there?
There's cowbell on lots of songs on this album.
Yeah.
I've never heard. It's almost impossible for me to take the song seriously
with the cowbell
because it's so loud.
The cowbell.
The
is,
cowbell.
Yeah. And of course, cowbell's been made a joke since this song was made. This is a immediately accessible tune. It's a very likable tune, and I think they do a whole lot of things wrong with it. And I think the lyrics sound, you can see him writing, goes, okay, what rhymes with this?
Yeah,
what
yeah,
you
yeah.
can see that. And despite all of that, I enjoy the song quite a bit.
I mean, he wrote it in one afternoon while they were waiting to perform at the Fillmore in San Francisco. So I don't know how much of an, I'm not going to say he didn't put effort into it, but it wasn't like he labored and labored over the lyrics to this song.
But it's a good indication of these guys can sing. And Randy California has such a way with melody and
does
and
absolutely
harmony, and it's just beautiful. Well,
this is irresistible. To me, it sounds like one of these songs that's already written that the artist discovers.
Yeah,
and even the little, and this is something he's going to do throughout this album, is these little just flourishes. Uh-huh. Because here's the thing: as great of a guitar player, he's not showing off on this album anywhere.
No, that's when you watch him live on all these things, he's letting everybody else do these flashy leads, and then he'll take it.
Well, I saw one of him where he is, it's just a three piece, and he does some of that, you know, weird finger tapping stuff. He gets all these strange harmonics. I mean, he's about half the time he is playing on the neck of the guitar, but it doesn't sound like Eddie Van Halen stuff. It's just beautiful.
But I think that's pretty impressive that this guy could do what he did and didn't like, oh, let me show you. And Doug, you and I were talking about this before the podcast. This is not a Randy California album. This is a band. Band is, they're all firing on the top of their game on this album.
They are.
I don't know. This is right after the Santa Barbara oil spill, which is the worst oil spill in California's history.
And Earth Day. This is right around the first Earth Day.
Oh, is it right? Yeah. So anyway, there's some focus on that. And it's nature's trying to warn us what we're doing to her. And it's nature's way of telling you, soon we'll freeze, which I don't know if anybody remembers.
I remember that, yeah.
In the early 70s, we were worried about the next ice age coming. Yeah. So I found that to be delicious.
This
is also after the book, what's it? Silent Spring.
Yeah. All these songs transition from one to another. And this song, the transition from this song to the next song is an exhaust car, a car that sounds like it needs a muffler, and a guy coughing.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know. I'm guessing that's in response to Nature's Way, but what's weird is the car horns leak into the next song, which I guess this next song kind of has some.
No, it's the same theme.
Same theme.
Yeah. One of the reasons this band did not make it is they refused to use fossil fuels on any of their tours.
Would you stop?
The next song. There's two songs on here that fall into the horrible person category. And that category means if you don't like these songs, you're a horrible person.
And this is one of them.
This is certainly one of them. Ladies and gentlemen, Animal Zoo.
The air I breathe and the water I drink is selling me short and turning me around. Everyone I see now on their way to everybody. So don't look now and don't ask how. Gonna find a way home to the Animal Zoo. Oh no, something went wrong. Well, you're much too fast.
I meant to say much too fat and a little too long in the opening. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. That would have been perfect.
This song is so fantastic.
It really, it's so good.
It doesn't take long to fall in love with this song.
The difference between this song and Nature's Way, though, is this song is nowhere near as serious about its subject matter as Nature's Way
is. Just listen to the end.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And just I love the little call and response between him and Randy California. You know, there's he'll say, it happens in the beginning of the verses where he'll say something and then Randy California will pipe in with this sort of sarcastic, like, so sad or so bad.
Yeah.
It's really.
It's a masterful song. And that then it breaks down and that bass just does.
Oh, yeah.
The bass riff is fantastic in the song.
I think when I said exuberant, this is one of the songs that that gives that away. Wonderful song.
And this is a song that could have easily been just bombastic. As you know, mm-hmm. all get out. I mean, you could have had Keith Moon playing drums on this, but the way that Ed Cassidy plays them.
Well, and I love those drum rolls he does. Yeah. And the boom.
Yeah.
Explain to me how this is not huge on the radio.
I don't have any idea.
We couldn't tour. They're on bicycles.
Stop. But I mean, it's even got this kind of semi-country guitar solo in the middle of it. It seems perfect for radio.
I have no idea how this song isn't covered 100 times too. It's fun.
Is it the most accessible track on the album?
I think it is. I think Nature's Way is
okay
because that tune is just immediately, you can comprehend that tune before you're even finished hearing the first four verse.
It's so hard for me to hear this song and not want to make an ass of myself dancing around the house.
Yeah,
it's so much fun.
Yeah. You know? I had to stop it. I had to stop working and get up.
This was written by Jay Ferguson. This was a Jay Ferguson song, not a Randy California song, which explains why it might have a little bit more humor to it. Because I think Randy California was much more like, hey, man.
You know what's funny about that is I can't look at Randy California without thinking of somebody.
Who's that?
Will Ferrell.
I don't see that, but I'll have to look at it again. I don't see it either,
but yeah, I'll have to look
at it. Well, I got to admit, I haven't seen much of him during this. It's more his later years. And that just, I don't even know if that is accurate. I don't know if anybody else would have the same. But the first thing I thought when I saw him playing with a big band, I said, it looks like Will Ferrell. And that makes it hard to take him serious.
Yeah. Well, I think in general, this band, I think they did have fun on stage. I think they were kind of goofy on stage too. So I think a lot of people who saw them, there was this weird sort of, I'm listening to this and this is great, but look at these guys. There's a big guy bound. Look at the drums. I mean, that's just, all of that just seemed kind of silly, I think. But,
well, I love silly. And,
well, this song is silly.
We talked about this before. When you get our age, it's silly is much more attractive than serious. I don't know how I would have responded to this in my 20s.
Well,
but I love it now. And speaking of love has found a way.
Yep.
Some are reaching for the gun, some are searching for the sun.
That's a ballsy production.
Yeah, this song could be a mess, but I really like it.
What would you call this? Like, what? I mean, if you had to pigeonhole this song, what would you call this song music wise? It's kind of proggy, but it's jazzy.
Very jazzy.
And then it's got that thump, 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 thump.
What? Yeah. So that backward masking, is that a cymbal or drum? What is that?
Yeah, I think it's a cymbal. There's a cymbal.
And they just masked it backwards throughout the entire song.
If I were in charge of producing this, I would have said, no, we're not doing that. We're going to do it over. You have a very attractive melody here, and we're not going to do it this way. But since I didn't produce it and someone else had to do it, I like it. I like all the quirky weirdness about it.
Well, and the opening chord progression doesn't make any sense. I don't even know if you're actually playing real chords.
Yeah, well, it starts off kind of chromatic.
Yeah.
It starts off with those space sounds though.
Yeah, sounds are cool.
Yeah.
Got to have your space sounds.
And this was Randy California and John Locke co-wrote this song. And you could tell John Locke's kind of all over it.
Yeah.
You know what we didn't talk about is there's a Moog all over this album.
Yeah, Moog all over this.
And I don't know
how. It makes some tweets and and it does some of the, even some of that helicopter sounding stuff that's kind of in the background. And then there's a song on here where you can really hear it.
This song is, what's interesting to me about this song, every time I hear it, it's slightly jarring.
It is. It is.
But it's never uninteresting.
No.
And I never want to not listen to it.
You always think it's going
to
go someplace and it goes someplace different. Yeah.
And it doesn't really resolve.
You know what this... it sounds like Todd Rundgren got hold of it.
Oh, maybe a little bit. Yeah. This even, but what's so even funny about this is, as odd as the song is, you can't keep the hippie out of it. Was it
no.
Some are reaching for a gun, some are reaching for the sun.
Which are you going to be?
But love will find a way. I mean, even the title, you know.
Yeah. And but then it, when it go after that, that it's got that kind of instrumental.
Oh
break
yeah,
in there. I just love that.
Yeah, the bridge is fantastic on this song.
It's this is not an easily accessible song, but it should be more difficult than it is.
Yeah,
there's something about it that I find it easy to get into.
It would be very easy to screw this song
up. And speaking of the sun, by the time these people hear it, we will know whether or not the sun's going to return. How many days are we away from the eclipse?
9.
Yeah, and we're right in the path, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right. We're dead center.
My zip code.
Start pulling people's hearts out of their bodies and throwing them in a pile.
Figure out how many we have to kill to get the sun to come
back.
That's
right.
It's got to be done. Yeah. Why can't I be free?
That's a good question, Doug. Why can't you be free?
Is to be free. And I cry when you say, just can't go on. Why can't I be free?
This reminds me of Steve Miller.
Well, that kind of the spacey vocals to it?
Yeah. Especially on Sailor, where he's doing, what's that song he does? Well, he does it on he does this on that other album, the one we covered,
Brave New World.
But he does where he's talking about spending the day together, and it sounds like Quicksilver Girl and all of those kind of hippie San Francisco sounding things. I like this song a lot.
I do. It's beautiful. The harmonies are fantastic.
The harmonies and the guitar harmonies.
Guitar is great.
Yeah.
What's that? How does he get that ringing tone? What is that?
I think he's just got it. He's doing some sort of harmonic with his pick, and he's got it compressed. I don't know how they did compression back then, but he's able to just keep that chime going through the thing. It's beautiful.
I've got two nitpicks with this song. One is I could do without the breathy vocals.
That's one of the things that remind me of Steve Miller.
And it's way too short.
Yeah. It seems like this almost
it's
seems
a
like,
minute, 3 seconds.
Yeah.
It's so, I love it when it comes on, and by the time I'm getting into it, it's over with.
Yeah. And then it leads into the next song, but yeah.
It deserves a longer place on this record.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Some of y'all are thinking I'm crazy because you don't know about Steve Miller back in his early psychedelic days. I'm not trying to say it sounds like Fly Like an Eagle or Jet Airliner.
Yeah. I heard this and immediately thought of Jet Airliner.
Anyway, but that made me quickly fall in love with that song.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like one of the things that I wanted it to do was have a longer guitar solo in it because it's just so pretty.
He doesn't do that.
I mean,
there's not long guitar solos on this album.
No.
I think you could listen to this record a couple of times without realizing how good of a guitar player
absolutely.
He is. Absolutely. Because he doesn't share it.
He doesn't show off.
And now, Tony.
Last song on side one.
Mr. Skin.
Yeah, don't try to do research looking that up because
you'll get
sites pull up, unfortunately.
Afraid you'll end up in a bad place.
You'll see Phoebe Cates' famous
Jam about to make a confession. That's one that got some radio play.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, not till later, though.
Yeah.
It was in 73 when Epic decided to re-release their first and third album as a twofer.
Yeah.
And they released Mr. Skin as a single at that time. And it hit number 92 in 73. This is Spirit doing R&B and soul music, and it's fantastic.
It is. It's got that galloping organ at the start of it.
Oh, yeah, the organ especially. Yeah. I mean, this is what's funny about this is it's got all the elements that you'd think of as like your kind of, and I don't want to, I'm not trying to downplay soul or R&B music, but your kind of traditional R&B tropes, but it's done through Spirit's lens, which makes it something other than that, you know?
It's very that folk, you know where it came from, but it sounds very different.
This is the most soulful their voices are too on it, you know. It's just
and who's Mr. Skin?
I think we mentioned that, didn't we? Oh, nope. It's Ed Cassidy.
Yeah,
because of his head.
Yeah, because of his head. I thought maybe
he had a nickname or something.
I threatened to mention that several times, maybe didn't. Yeah, Ed Cassidy, the drummer, he was shaved his head, and they called him Mr. Skin.
And he's probably, if you do Google it, he'll probably be the 158,000th thing that pops up. There'll be some other things that pop up.
And this has also got, it's got a sax solo, and then it's got...
Oh, the horns are so good on this song.
And then it's got the most Hendrix-sounding guitar solo on it. You know, that part where you go,
I want to say something that Tony said about the horns I disagree with. He said the horns are so good on this song. I would like to change that. The horns are so good on this album.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There is nothing that can be inserted into a song that's more inappropriate than horns. Right. There are so many occasions where I said, no, please don't understand. No. You did that wrong. This album, wherever they come in, they do their job, but they don't do too much.
Yeah.
They leave you a little bit wanting. Can I have some more of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love the horns on this record.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
Yeah, they're fantastic. Is there too much cowbell on this song? it's a frenetic cowbell in this one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like ringing.
It's not steady.
It's like dinner time.
It is not a metronome like the first one. Now, the thing, though, I gotta say this again. These guys can do anything. And they can say anything, and I don't care.
You don't care.
Baby. It's like people are with their own kids. Mm-hmm. They got a kid that's tearing up the restaurant. They're the only ones that don't notice. Yeah. That's how I am with this band. I mean, they can do whatever they want, and they can say any stupid thing they want.
Yep. Yeah.
You can't have a record come out at this period of time without something about space.
Well, you got to flip it over first, though, Doug.
Oh, I forgot. We flipped it over, y'all. We took a little break for album flippage, and it is now flipped over, and we're on Space Child, baby. Great lyrics.
Can you say Moog? It does have piano in it.
It does have piano in it. I love the way this... whole song.
I do, too.
It's the most spaciest of the space songs that came out at this time.
So...
We got to make a big playlist of all the space tunes from the early 70s and late 60s.
Again, I think this is where they get their prog, where people talk about it being prog, but this,
it is pretty
again,
proggy.
Yeah, it still sounds jazz to me. So it sounds jazzy, more jazzy than prog to me.
Yeah.
I think the only reason you'd say prog is because you have to put it in a category that...
This is John Locke wrote this, obviously, because it's a very keyboard heavy tune, but...
And the bass on this is pretty cool. Randy California gets credit for playing bass on this. I wonder if this is his bass playing on it, because it's not playing like a regular bass.
Well, maybe. That's interesting. I didn't know he got credit for playing bass.
Yeah,
because he on subsequent albums when it was just him and Ed Cassidy and one other guy, he usually had a bassist with him. I guess so he could they could play it live. I don't know, maybe why. But yeah. anyway.
Well, he's not the only bass player. Obviously.
No, I know, obviously. But
is this song groovy?
It's pretty groovy.
It's got a good space. I think it's space groovy.
It's got it. Yeah,
I think that it's.
I mean, you could see that. The Moog part, that's that when it starts jazzing up a little bit, you can see like somebody being in New York walking around and looking in windows and looking at department store windows and just walking with a balloon in Central Park or something.
I didn't see any of that. I see a bunch of hippies with a big wah-wah amoebas on the wall.
Well, there's that, but the undercurrent, there's so many piano flourishes that bring this back down to earth, so to speak. you know, that ground it in a way. Again, it's something that why is this attractive? Why does this work? Why do I like listening to this? Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to explain it.
It starts off one way and it goes in a totally different direction, and then it comes back and then it goes in another direction.
It's one of those things that plays with your head while you listen to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly how I fell in love with jazz. And I was in Sweet Basil and these old men were up doing something, and all of a sudden my head felt different than it ever had been before. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
And there was no substance involved, ladies and gentlemen. That was just
this music,
funky music doing things to my head. Here we go. When I touch you, I don't like saying that with just you two guys in here. All right.
This is my favorite vocal performance on this album.
It is a very good vocal performance.
You know who it's it doesn't sound like him, but I could hear Paul Rodgers singing this song.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know,
it's definitely like that kind of vocal
crescendo.
Performance. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that distorted guitar riff that's going through it. It might be, they might have done it a little too much, but I still just absolutely.
This is, again, where that kind of proto-metal thing tag gets thrown onto them, because this is essentially kind of, you can hear this being an influential song to people who are listening to it thinking, oh, I like that riff, you know, and that sound.
But it never it's one of those where they never resolve.
It never stops being music.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You know what's his song has hand claps in it.
It's got hand claps. And if you listen really, this is one of the songs I was talking about. If you listen really closely, the Moog on this is really, there's cascading Moog stuff going on in the background. That, you know.
And as it gets great as it fades out, and Randy California is able to kind of showboat a little bit.
Yeah, he does showboat a little bit on this.
But that's okay.
I love it.
I would say a little bit more, Randy.
Yeah.
I'd never get enough of that.
But this is a perfect vehicle for that.
Yeah.
This song.
Yeah. I wish it weren't called.
Speaking of vehicles generally ride on streets. Mm-hmm. And we have Street Worm. I'm never bound to make no deals. I'll be happy staying with the baby. I'll be happy swimming for horses in the country. It's another Jay Ferguson number.
Yeah. It's another song that Randy California gets to showboat a little bit.
Yeah, he does showboat on this one too.
It's his most musical sounding solo, I think, on it. But he also does those little runs.
Yeah, those runs
at the end of
it,
yeah.
This is every time I hear this song, I think of Boris the Spider for some reason by the Who.
That's funny.
It is a kind of a Who sounding song, but. God, the vocals, another great vocal.
No, it is. This is a fantastic, the cowbell returns as well.
The drums are so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love how all the chaos breaks out at the end of it, too. Yep. This is a good one. It's a little bit, maybe not. I was going to say it's a little bit similar to Animal Zoo, but there's something else going on there, too.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but.
It's an interesting song. It's definitely not my favorite song on the album, but it's a good one.
Well, we got Life has just begun, excuse me for not saying it right.
I love this song. This is my favorite song on the album.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you, if you think you know what's coming next during the song, you're going to be
Oh, it's so soaring. Yeah. It's impossible to get a good center of the song because it just goes all over the place, but it's so soaring.
This is the one song where I can, you know, when people talk about, oh, music from California, this sounds very much like it came from LA, this song. You know, the same way Love does, feels like it came from LA, and not the San Francisco variety of California music or whatever. How is this not a single?
I don't know. And it's so... Another thing that this shows off how Randy California has such a... He can sound so different. That guitar part, the acoustic guitar part, I guess that's a 12-string that he's playing. It's just beautiful.
I love that effect on the voice right before the chorus kicks in. And the pianos or keys are great on this.
Yeah, the keys are fantastic on this. Yeah, again, it starts off, it sounds like it's just going to be some little love song, but it just goes into such a beautiful place.
As complicated as it is, it's another very accessible song. Again, if this had been a single, I think it probably would have done well. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, y'all want to skip the next one?
No.
Ladies and gentlemen, we do have a You're a Horrible Person song coming up next. I feel like Odysseus. I'm going to need to be tied to the mast, and someone else is going to have to turn it off because I will play the whole thing and start it over again. Ladies and gentlemen, morning will come. There's three tunes right there, ladies and gentlemen. All three of them are great.
Yeah. Another one with the horns are just
perfect.
Horns are perfect on this.
They could not be better. And the voice,
his voice is great.
It's big and perfect and exuberant.
And another thing, how is this not a single? I hear T-Rex and Bowie.
I was about to say, yes, I was going to say, it sounds like T-Rex and Bowie to me.
I hear that too, and I hear something else, and I can't put my finger on it. I hear something, I don't know how to describe this, but those bands where they have a bunch of good singers, like the Monkees or Bay City Rollers, or there's something, maybe it's just because it's such pure pop.
Yeah. Well,
with the hook, three hooks.
Yeah.
The other band I hear is the MC5 on this.
I hear the MC5. Yeah. You know what? This is going to sound strange. I hear a little bit of REM.
Like, really?
Yeah. Just kind of
I don't hear that.
They're rocking, like Monster era. I don't know why, but that was one of the things that popped out to me.
It's such a great song.
I tell you what, when I say that about the Monkees and those, it sounds like a song that was so obviously good that the A&R guy goes, okay, I got it. I'm taking it to my guys.
I don't know how this gets on the album and they don't immediately go, oh, well, here's our first single.
Yeah.
Here you go. We're good.
When I heard this, I said, why is this not one that I say, you know, they play this too much, but I never get tired of it. It seems like it ought to be on AM or on FM. When I go to one of these places that has album rock playing and it's over and over and over again, I don't understand why this isn't among those.
Yeah. When I pulled up today, I was a little embarrassed because your wife was out here in front of the garage and I had my windows down and I had this song absolutely blaring, this particular song absolutely blaring out of my car. So,
Well,
it makes the drive out here much easier.
I don't know what else to say except
it's a damn perfect song.
It's a perfect, it's a nice thing to drive.
It's a great drive song. If you think you don't like Spirit, take the Morning Will Come challenge. Listen to this song three times, and if you don't like it, okay, we'll accept that. But you will be a horrible person. What a great tune. And up next,
We have a song called Soldier.
Last song on the album.
We're going to finish her up here if I can make it work. I'd let you understand. That band plays really well together.
sure do.
I will say, first of all, it's not surprising this is how they chose the end of the album. This mm-hmm. is Spirit after all. I'm not sure I would have ended it with this song. I mean, it's not bad. I don't think it's bad, and the album holds together well. But, if you'd had like the last song on it, I don't know if you could end with that. But you'd automatically want to flip the album over and listen to it again if The Morning Will Come had ended the album. But again, this is Spirit we're talking about, and it makes sense that this is the album or the song that closes the album. I just, personal choice, you know?
I think there could have been a coda or something at the end of this album that would have made it kind of bringing it back.
Her Majesty?
just like something, a reprise of the first song.
I feel like that's a pretty good ending. And it's like the... It's not like what we already heard.
It sounds like it's like the band or Procol Harum.
Yeah, it's a fantastic song. I'm not saying that. I'm not knocking how you're not. Great the song is.
The organ at the very end, that pipe organ at the very end that ends this, mm-hmm. absolutely beautiful.
It's just another example of you didn't know they sounded like this.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Well, T.
Yeah.
What do you have to say for yourself? You made JM and I really appreciate this album. Mm-hmm. You made me feel like an idiot for not knowing about it.
Well, you've done that for me plenty of times, too.
Yeah. Well, that feels good to know that. nothing more important in life than making someone else feel bad. But this is a great album. And if you don't have it, just go get it.
Yeah.
You can buy the CD at eBay for
and
really cheap.
The CD has some three or extras. Four bonus tracks, and they're all great songs.
Yeah, they
There's
are.
Not a, I mean, those songs were outtakes as well. I think a couple of them were B-sides, and they're great.
They are.
They're fantastic.
At this point, we're going to talk about where this band went from here on out.
Well, yeah. First of all, I just want to say this album, when it was released, we talked about a bit, wasn't a success. Although it did peak at number 31, but it was the
least selling
album of their career. It was a bit of a cult classic. It sold a lot overseas. It continued to do well in Europe and the UK. It wasn't certified gold until 1976 in the States. Six years after it was released. So,
yeah.
Okay. The history of this band's not the happiest.
No.
One of the issues with while they were recording this is, you know, in the past on their first three albums, pot was involved, LSD was around, cocaine got involved when this album was released or when they were working on it. And while they were mixing it, Randy California was on a horse and he fell off a horse and he fractured his skull. And during his recovery, evidently he was doing loads and loads and loads of cocaine. People who knew him said he never came out of that the same person. I don't want to go into a whole lot of that, but he was a difficult person to work with, evidently. The next Spirit album didn't even have him on it.
Yeah.
The other two guys, there's five guys in the band, but Andy's and Ferguson left and started a band called JoJo Gunn. Mm-hmm. And Randy California just kind of didn't want to do it. I think it was a combination of that, and from what I understand, Hendrix's death really hit him hard.
That's what I read too.
So he just kind of put his guitar down. So the next album Locke and Cassidy, right? Went out and they got some guys from Texas, I think, to fill the band out.
Yeah, and I think
Feedback was the name of that.
Feedback.
It's the only Spirit album with that. So Ed Cassidy's on every album that has the word Spirit on it. It's the only one without Randy California on it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Randy California does release a solo album called Captain Copter and the Fabulous Twirly Birds. and Ed Cassidy's on it. They get back together. They start playing various incarnations of Spirit throughout the years. They release albums with various people on it,
including Mark Andy's brother. He was actually on this album playing Dobro that we just talked about.
He actually became
a member of Spirit later. He guests on a lot of those albums.
Well, in 75, they release, it was their first album for Mercury. They released an album called Spirit of 76, and by all accounts, it's a double album. People love it. I haven't listened to it.
I probably should have,
but people absolutely love it. We talked about what happened in 84 when they got the original band back together and recorded 13th Dream. I'm kind of glossing over this because Randy California had some significant issues. I don't want to focus on that too much. The saddest thing though is that he ends up dying saving his son. Was it 97?
97, yeah. Right. And he really was kind of a nature dude, and he really didn't love being on the beach and all that sort of stuff. And so he was out with his son, and I guess they were surfing, but his son got caught in a riptide.
Yeah. I think they both did. Yeah. And he pushed his son to the Coast Guard, and then he didn't make
it.
He died.
What I guess that's the most noble death we've had and things we've covered.
Yeah. Ed Cassidy died in 2012 at the age of 89. He had cancer, but he had a career a bit. He also acted some. He was in General Hospital a little bit, which is kind of funny. I have to see if I can find clips of that. And then we talked about what the other guys did. Ferguson wrote the theme song to The Office. And Andy's was a bass player and played with a bunch of different people. They never really had a whole lot of success. They've always kind of been a cult band, if you will, influencing a whole lot of musicians and not really having much of a commercial appeal to people outside of that. But they're a fantastic band.
You know, and that's the thing. I said this earlier, but I think we weren't recording. But I think so many bands after them tried to emulate what Spirit was doing. And, you know, we're talking about Lou Adler. Like, it seemed like even Lou Adler was trying to find that where it's not proggy, but you can still, they've got some prog elements in it, and where you've got keyboards and guitars kind of interplaying with each other, and you've got, you know, just pianos and synthesizers kind of being used in like a hard rock vein. And it just seems so many bands have tried it and just falling flat on their butts. And, you know, I'm thinking of Styx. I'm thinking of like Kansas.
I don't know why you keep bringing Kansas in.
Because it seems like they tried to kind of do this acoustic stuff, and it just, and then
Kansas was just trying to be the American Yes.
I don't know. Yeah. But
one thing I notice about this band, that most of these bands that we've talked about, they'll have five good albums, and then personnel starts switching up, and then there's this long list of albums that never needed to be made again that are in one or two stars. These albums go on a long time, and they continue to be well reviewed all the way to the end. And
well, like I said, when I saw them in 90, they'd released an album that was getting airplay again. It was kind of resurgence for them.
Let's see, in 90, I have Tent of Miracles.
That may have been the album.
That's a 4-star record, according to All Music Guide. So that's unusual for a band to be able to have personnel changes and also go that long and still put out stuff that's considered good stuff. Anyway, I got a lot of work to do on Spirit. A long way to go with it. This was definitely fun. A lot more fun than next week. Anyway, Tony, not remember.
Oh, yeah. I'll be good, I promise.
Anyway, this is where we give a review. We pretend that we're critics, and we give a critical review that comes from strictly our minds. And then we give a very emotional and heartfelt review, which comes from our hearts. And one's about our taste, and one's about trying to be objective. And I'm going to go to Jonathan J.M. Rowe first, because he's not Tony.
All right. So I'm going to go with my critic rating first. It's a 4 or 5. This is about as perfect an album as there could be for the times, I think. I understand why it's so highly regarded, and I understand why their other albums are really highly regarded. I listened to just Spirit and put it on the, a Spirit playlist on Amazon Music, and I didn't hear a clunker in any of the stuff that I was hearing. And you know, I'm kind of like Doug. I'm surprised it's not more highly regarded than it is. So I'm going to give my personal rating as well. It's going to be the same thing, a 4 or 5. Tony, I can't thank you enough for making me pull this album out and listening to it again. I enjoyed every minute of it. And the playing is great. The harmonies are amazing. There's variety within every song on every, you know, within songs themselves. The only thing is the lyrics do get a little cloying sometimes, so that knocks it down a little bit. But overall, it's a fantastic album and one I shan't forget again.
He shan't.
I shan't.
Thank you, Jonathan J.M. Rowe. I will go next because I also am not Tony. Critically, I'm going to give this album a 4.8, and that's because I don't know it well enough to give it a 5-star review. It probably isn't a 5-star album, but it's barely not a 5-star album. And my personal review will be 4.9 because I'm still giddy in love. I'm in the early stages of love with this album where everything's magical and you haven't gotten into your first argument yet.
It stays out.
Maybe it will. Who knows? But thanks, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony, let's hear from you.
I don't think this is a 5 album because I just want to reserve that for certain things that rise above everything. While this is a fantastic album, 4.8 feels right to me critically. The lyrics I don't care about because I sing along with them, but I don't care about them. Musically, it's just so much fun to listen to this album. There's just so much going on. I've listened to this album for decades and it still keeps me on my toes. Even listening to it as in-depthly as I did over the last bit of time to prepare for this, it kept me on my toes. So 4.8. Critically, I'm all... Or that was that my critic or my...
That was your critic.
Okay, I got confused there for a minute. I'm going to give it the... Because I'm going to give it the same. I'm going to give it a 4.8 for my personal review, too. Again, I never get tired of it. It's just a great album. And there are lots of things in their catalog worth listening to. This is their masterwork. Most people agree to that. We've done albums on this podcast that are head scratchers why they weren't more accessible to people at the time. This is one of them. The Love album is another one. I think Odyssey and Oracle by the Zombies is another mm-hmm. one. You're like, how are these not bigger albums? You know, people found out about them later and were kicking themselves for not, no offense, Doug, kicking themselves for not being fans of this stuff.
Well, I've already given myself an award.
That's true. Anyway, that's a long, long-winded explanation. 4.8 for both.
Thank you, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you, dear listener, for listening to this episode of This Is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. Tell your friends about us, especially if they like the long player format. We're available on most podcasting platforms. And you can visit our Facebook group page or email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But as always, for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, visit our website, www.tappingvinyl.com. You'll find ways to listen to all our past episodes and find ways to find our recommendations. There's videos, there's pictures, anecdotes of the artists we've talked about. That's www.tappingvinyl.com. Next week, we're going to be looking at an album from 1968 by one of the biggest bands in the world, the Rolling Stones, Beggar's Banquet. For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe, thanks for listening to This Is Vinyl Tap, and we're hoping love finds a way to you.
Let go your mind.
I tried. I need it. I need the doobie.
Why?
I think the doobies are what made everybody free. What do I have to do? I won't get off Mr. Skin.
To restart? It won't get off Mr. Skin. I promise. I promise I didn't click on it. It won't get off Mr. Skin.
Yeah, y'all could blackmail me with that quote.